good, I told him. He tried it. It worked. We took bike rides in the Vegas desert at high noon so he could train in the most challenging conditions. We flew to Europe to try the first cryotherapy chambers, where we literally walked around inside a frigid chamber, totally immersed in temperatures that make today's cryo tubes feel toasty. I had him eat pizza as a pregame meal when he had back-to-back games because it boosted his energy and stamina. Even his decision to use a helicopter on game days from Orange County to Staples Center was about thinking of new ways to get that slight edge because it gave him time away from everything and everyone before a game. I know the helicopter came to represent catastrophic tragedy, but he had no fear of what could go wrong. If he thought something would give him an advantage, he wanted it. It's no coincidence that the greats figure out what works for them, regardless of what everyone else does. Dwayne didn't just work out on game days, he liked to work out right before the game. He preferred to be at home in the mornings. That was his time to relax. So before home games, I'd meet him at the arena at 6 p.m. before game time, and we'd go through a set of movements for around 20 minutes, take practice shots for 10 minutes away from the crowd, just enough to get his body feeling the way he wanted it to feel. He had the whole weight room and practice court to himself, and he used that time to mentally and physically prepare. No one told him to do that. It was his way of creating an environment and schedule that allowed him to perform at a higher level. LeBron James is another great who figured out his own path to winning. He essentially created the super team phenomenon in the NBA by deciding where he wanted to play and with whom, knowing he'd be criticized for going against the way others had managed their careers in the past. Everyone was telling him what to think, where to play, and what to do. He exercised his right to think for himself and changed not only the course of his career, but the direction of the NBA. I hear from players every season who say, "Let's work together. I'll do whatever it takes." Then I tell them what it takes, and they can't even comprehend what I'm talking about. Not because it's so complex, but because it's not what they're accustomed to. They've always trained one way. It's all they know. But if you're not getting results doing what you know, if you need to plan our work around your vacations, if you get injured every season and can't figure out why, maybe it's time to think about new ways to achieve what you're chasing. To me, it isn't about what's right or wrong, it's about deciding what you will or won't negotiate for yourself, and whether you're willing to expand your thinking in a way that allows you to move closer to winning than your competition. People get caught up in their non-negotiables, those rules and beliefs that can't be altered because why? Because everyone says so? Because that's the way you've always done it? You can tell yourself over and over that you won't negotiate your dreams, your goals, your plans, but if you get to the point where those things aren't working, you might have to start negotiating with yourself. Not with others. With yourself. You have to be careful with non-negotiables, because while it sounds tough and badass to announce what you absolutely will and will not do, there are infinite things that can get in the way and force you to change direction. Most people did not begin 2020 planning to homeschool their kids or work from the kitchen table. They didn't plan on their gyms closing. My athletes didn't plan on living in a bubble or playing shortened seasons. My corporate clients didn't plan on running their businesses via Zoom calls. Try clinging to your non-negotiables when everything you planned is suddenly yanked out of your grasp. Your non-negotiables have to be things you, and only you, can control. The food you eat, the effort you commit, the words you speak, the results you deliver. If you can't personally control the outcome, you're dealing in goals that will potentially require you to adapt, change direction, get creative, and think differently about managing the obstacles that block your path. Our team is going to win the title. Our business is going to triple its revenue. My kid is going to med school. Non-negotiable or wishful thinking? Winning hears your promises and laughs out loud. If you don't control it, you'd better be prepared to negotiate for it. and the negotiation never stops. I've seen great competitors get to the top by refusing to negotiate their ambition to win. They made every right choice, committed the time and effort, and did the work better than anyone. But as soon as they won, they renegotiated everything. The celebration began, the pressure was off, the priorities changed, and the focus on winning was suddenly blurred by the pursuit of countless other things. For my clients, I have one non-negotiable: performance. Everything contributing to that is open to discussion, as long as we arrive at the same end result. If it helps you to train on a game day, if you perform better with a steak in your diet, if you want to ride a bike in the 120-degree desert, you have my full support, as long as your performance proves the benefits. You need to have that drink? Okay with me. I know all the studies on the effects of alcohol on performance, but I have also seen firsthand what a glass of wine can do to relax the body and mind. I'm not prescribing it or telling you to do it. If you need to go to that party and have some fun, I understand. But if your performance starts to make people wonder where you were the night before, now we're going to need some limits and restrictions. Because the one thing we're not going to negotiate is anything that adversely impacts your performance. If you're out until 5 a.m., if you had a lot to drink, if you smoked to relax, I'll judge you by your results. Did you play like garbage the next day? We're going to have to talk about what happened the night before. You played great? Remind me what you did the night before. We might need to do that again. I can't remember all the times I trusted my own thinking and succeeded, but I can remember the times I ignored my own thoughts, did what I was told to do, and failed. A few years ago, I was speaking to a huge audience of business owners, mostly male, very affluent, very conservative. There were several speakers at this event, and I was doing the closing keynote. The organizer of the event made one request of all the speakers: no cursing. "We don't really mind, but the audience is very conservative," we were told, "and we don't want to offend anyone." Now, I can curse, or I cannot curse. I'm sure it won't surprise you to know I'm much more comfortable when I can be myself on the stage, which means occasionally cursing. But I'm also respectful of groups and audiences who don't enjoy that, and I always comply when asked to keep it clean. So I'm waiting to take the stage, and I'm listening to the guy who is speaking ahead of me. He's a former Navy SEAL, talking about leadership and teamwork. And he's using words I wouldn't even whisper in a locker room. Not a single sentence without an F-bomb. And I look out into the audience, and they are loving it, laughing, clapping, with a huge standing ovation at the end. And now I have a decision to make. I gave these people my word there'd be no cursing, at least from me. Do I break my word and ignore their request, as he did, because I know the audience will enjoy the talk I want to give, or do I follow the rules and keep it clean? I kept my word, because that's a non-negotiable for me, and I followed the rules. And it was the first time I hated my own speech. Not because I used clean language. I was being respectful, which was the appropriate thing to do, but because I let someone else tell me what was right when I knew they were wrong. And that is also a non-negotiable for me. One of my non-negotiable core values is trusting my instincts and believing what I know. I might be wrong, but I want the chance to be right. And I'd rather decide for myself than allow others to decide for me. Winning does not negotiate. You won or you lost. It doesn't care how hard you worked. It doesn't care about extenuating circumstances that got in your way. You worked hard? That's nice. I need someone who works hard, smart, fast, and a whole mess of other things. Get back in line and figure it out. Figure it out. Put your craziness to work. Innovate. Don't imitate. And above all, stop listening to everyone who tells you what to think. If they knew, they'd all be winners.
A huge part of your work with people is getting them to understand that their issues are not necessarily the tasks and the daily challenges they face, and that much of what holds us back is what's going on in our head all day and all night and all day and all night, like a battlefield, a minefield, with bombs everywhere that are constantly going off. And until we can learn to control those, we can't control that battlefield. Can you talk about that and the challenges that people face in dealing with that on an ongoing basis?
Everyone is trying to deal with external battlefields, external issues, when the biggest war is actually going on inside your own head. When you're dealing with anger, when you're dealing with fear, when you're dealing with anxiety, those are all loaded bombs, and they go off when they're not supposed to. Do you know how to defuse them? Do you know how to deal with distractions? Do you need to blow up your routine? Are you just repeating the same things over and over again and expecting to win in an unforgiving race? Until you learn to defuse and work your way through the battlefield that's going on in your own mind, you're going to get blown right out of the race before you even get started.
All right, well, we're going to battle. Let's go.
Number one, winning wages war on the battlefield in your mind.
I don't know a better way to say this, so if it offends you, well, that's on you. Winning fucks with your mind. It just does. There's nothing else that can whip you around faster and harder. You're just getting started, and instantly, it's over. You're feeling calm and cool, and suddenly you're burning up. You're face-to-face with triumph when you feel it slap you from behind. You're completely in charge until you realize someone else is controlling everything. You finally get your arms around winning, and it leaves you on the floor gasping for breath. You give everything you have for one glorious victory and discover it isn't ever going to be enough. Like I said, winning fucks with your mind. There's no way you can't be affected by it. That's true for the greatest champions in history, and equally true for anyone who has ever craved victory and achieved it. 1 minute they're exploding with joy at the moment of triumph, and a day later they're facing the reality that to keep that feeling, they have to do it all over again. And this time, it will be twice as hard. Winning is a war, and it's fought on the battlefield in your mind. On this battlefield, there is no rest. Your mind never stops. You have no peace. I don't care if you're living in a 12-bedroom mansion or on a friend's couch in the garage. When you're in the race to win, you spend every night sleeping with the enemy. And that enemy is you, the one person who knows all your weaknesses and fears, knows everything you crave and dread, and never stops using them against you. Winning fills your head with a minefield of ideas and warnings and questions, and detonates them all at once. Your thoughts keep fighting even when you're asleep, preparing for the threat of imagined battles that haven't happened yet. They might happen, they might not. You go to bed tired and wake up tired because there's a raging onslaught of chaos in your head, and there's no nap that can erase that. The minute you wake up, you're fighting again. Your mind is so overrun with conflict that you can't even remember going to sleep. All day, every day, your mental battlefield is attacked by blasts of adrenaline and anger and fear and anxiety and other explosives too. Stress, insecurity, doubt, envy. Sometimes it's a stranger who puts them there. Sometimes it's someone close to you. Sometimes it's you. Most of the time, it's you. If you look closely, you can read the labels on the bombs. You can't win. Terrible idea. Everyone is laughing. You look ridiculous. This is going to cost too much. Fuck those people. Not all of those minds are cruelly harsh. They can also be dangerously kind. You should take the day off. You work too hard. You're better than the others. They have no chance. You've already won. Relax. Enjoy. Don't take everything so seriously. Winners can detect those bombs and defuse them before they can do any damage. Losers brace for impact and wonder how to clean up the mess. You know all about those explosives, and you know exactly what's going to set them off. But by the time you're ready to deal with them, you're tired, distracted, confused. You're trying to find peace, a calm, serene place to think, and instead you find yourself in a wild mental war zone with smoke and explosions and all kinds of screaming, probably yours. And just as you're about to defuse this one ticking time bomb, you feel another blast detonating, and it's 5 times more explosive. 1 minute you're managing sparklers, and the next thing you know, a grenade just went off over there. You're fighting fires everywhere, and as soon as you extinguish one, another bursts into flames. Everyone wants to set the world on fire, but you also have to control how it burns. Winning loves that battle. How much can you take? How far can I push you? Are you having fun yet? I don't care how much skill and talent you have, what plans you've dreamed, what promises you've made. If you can't dominate this battlefield, you can't win. This is your space, your territory. It's yours to dominate, or someone else will. Are you able to extract those explosives from the minefield? Do you have the mental strength and agility? Are you aware of the distractions, insecurities, and false beliefs planted in your mind? This is what enables great winners to separate from everyone else. They have losses and failures, they face criticism and commentary and all kinds of obstacles, but they consistently possess the stark ability to win those mental battles, shut them down, and move on to the next fight. Your mental battlefield is the command center of every decision you make. If you decide something is a problem, then it's going to be a problem. When you wake up in the middle of the night worrying about money, you can either figure out a way to handle your finances, or you can lay in the dark worrying about how you'll never dig out. Before a big game or important meeting, you can think of all the ways you could screw up, or you can mentally walk through the details you'll need to make it all work. When you make a mistake, when you experience failure, you can step on the mine that explodes the loser bomb, or you can navigate yourself to a better place where you have the clarity to plan your next move. Trust me, I'm not going to talk to you about the BS of positive thinking and visualizing. You can visualize being a winner, you can envision that moment of glory, you can think positive about how it's all going to work. It's a nice daydream, but daydreaming is as effective as calling a disconnected number. Wake up. None of that has happened yet. Winning doesn't visit you in your dreams. It sees you in your nightmares. What are the thoughts that dance into your head in the middle of the night when it's finally quiet enough for you to hear yourself think? Did I get enough done? Could I have worked harder? Can I do this? Am I kidding myself? Am I ever going to make it? Those thoughts can trigger disaster for many who fear they're failing. They wake up every day in a panic, facing another day of anxiety and dread. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm a fraud and everyone is going to see it. I'm never going to make it. I'm a mess. I can't do this. But for others, those thoughts are a blueprint for improvement. Did I get this right? Can I do better? I know what to do. I need to make that happen. And they move in on those bombs, inspecting them from every angle until they can extract and defuse them. That was Kobe. I can't rest until I make this shot I should have made today. He'd be playing that moment over and over in his head, trying to figure out what happened so it didn't happen again. He'd relive the game in his mind, watching film at 4 a.m. until he could understand why he missed that shot. What was going on with the defense? Where was the ball? Did it rotate correctly? Was it wet? Was it heavy? Was my head too far back? Did I catch it right? Was my elbow correct? He'd go through every possible variable until he could answer his own questions, and know with some certainty that the answer in his mind would resolve the issue on the court. Everything you do starts with your thoughts. How many times have you sabotaged your own goals and ambitions because your head wasn't in the right place? You wanted to lose 10 pounds, but the pizza looked so good. You wanted to quit drinking, but what the hell, it's been a hard day. You knew you should have made that one phone call, but you weren't sure what to say. You had all your plans in place to make a major move in your life, and you let someone talk you out of it. No one forced you into those choices. You just weren't prepared to win those battles. I've watched great players lose everything because they couldn't make that mental leap from wanting to win to making it happen. They started believing the hype and the bullshit and stopped believing in what got them there in the first place. This is not just about athletes, of course. It can happen to anyone, in any endeavor. I see it all the time with the business leaders and entrepreneurs I work with. One day, they're on a clear trajectory toward success, and then suddenly, they can't win at all. What happened? They didn't suddenly forget how to execute. Something else got in the way, and it's almost always something mental. I've dealt with so many athletes with brilliant talent whose careers were completely destroyed inside their mental bomb shelters. They believed every gratuitous compliment about their greatness, every grandiose tribute to their excellence. From the time they were kids, they were told how special they were, which may have been true enough at the high school or collegiate level. Unfortunately, they hadn't actually accomplished anything at the pro level, and instead of working harder to match their alleged potential, they bought into the hype and focused on building their brand instead of their results. Note, get the results and the brand will build itself. Play it the other way around and your career will be dead long before your shoe deal expires. That's how you sabotage yourself. Are you winning your own war? People find so many ways to derail their own success. Distractions, laziness, ego. Winning has a million ways to stop you if you don't have the resilience to fight back. How well do you deal with distractions? I'm sure you know people, including yourself, who have no ability to filter and manage issues with family and friends, addictions, financial problems, relationships, health, legal trouble. Everything that happens to them is their new reason for not getting to the finish line. They give their time and energy to everything and everyone, and then blame all those things that got in the way without ever once recognizing that the biggest obstacle in the way was themselves. And at the end of the day, their focus is on everything except the one thing that could have made it all work, winning. I'm not talking about distractions like watching videos on your phone or texting your friends or wandering into the kitchen for your 15th snack of the evening, although those are definitely distractions. I'm talking about the internal distractions caused by your own mental combat with yourself. If you're procrastinating, if you're constantly apologizing for things you did and didn't do, if you get to the end of the day and realize you didn't accomplish a single thing you wanted or needed to do, you're distracted by your own thoughts. We all have some kind of to-do list, but for most, it's a things-to-do-that-will-never-get-done list. Winners have a done list. You have a list that never gets shorter? Things you just can't seem to accomplish because you never have the time or knowledge or money or approval from others or whatever you claim is stopping you? Things you could have done when you were quarantined at home during the COVID-19 pandemic with literally nothing to do even after you watched every possible Netflix series? Do yourself a favor. Either do them or admit you're never doing them and move on. Managing that back burner is a ridiculous waste of time and energy. All those burners generate the same amount of heat anyway, and those things stay on your mind and taunt you every time you start thinking about everything you've left unfinished or unstarted. Get rid of them. You'll feel better immediately. Distractions can be fatal to your goals if you don't manage them. Notice I said manage, not eliminate. I know you've been told 1,000 times to eliminate distractions. Not possible. You might be able to erase some, But people are still going to need you. There will still be tasks and chores to do. The phone and the TV and the refrigerator are still going to be there, taunting you. And if those things are so distracting, enough that they've created an issue, they'll be even more distracting when you try to eliminate them. If you want to manage distractions and get control of that battle, you need to put some routines in place. I'm not talking about sticking with old routines designed to keep you comfortable and safe and get you through the day without rocking the boat, because sometimes that boat needs to be rocked. Hard. If you never rock that boat, how will you know how much it can take? This isn't about fighting boredom or dealing with anxiety or avoiding new things. I don't want to see you sleepwalking through your life, just getting by. We all know people who are just plodding through every day. They say things like, another day, another dollar. Easy come, easy go. Sun up, sun down. Just glad to be here. Same old, same old. If that's you, and I seriously hope it's not, you need to blow up that routine and replace it with something that engages you mentally and helps you create new challenges and results. To me, routines are freedom if you use them correctly. They allow you to take action with certainty and purpose. They remove the variables and speed bumps that slow you down. And most important, they bypass the battlefield decisions. Should I? Should I not? This way? That way? Today? Tomorrow? How long? Who should I ask? When you have a well-planned routine, those questions have already been answered. You execute and move on. Done. Next. MJ had the most disciplined game day routine I've ever seen, from the way he selected his timepiece to the way he laced his shoes. He planned and organized every detail of his day, from the time of his workout to the car he drove to the arena. He put his clothes on in a specific order, organized the game tickets for his family and friends, ate at the same time every day. Everything had purpose and discipline. And everyone on his personal team participated in those routines. I knew what time and how long we were working out, 5 a.m., 6 a.m., or 7 a.m. every day, even on road trips and travel days. His automobile manager knew which car he'd be driving and what time to have it washed and ready. MJ would never take a car that hadn't just been washed. The chef knew exactly what he'd be eating and what time we needed it served. Everything was planned and coordinated, so there were no bumps in the schedule. Part of his routine was to lace his shoes before every game, fresh out of the box. The ritual had special meaning to him. Every time he did it, he could remember that feeling of being a kid getting new shoes, and it took him to a place that prepared him mentally for the game and helped put him in the zone. One day on the road, the team bus was delayed coming into the arena, so I went ahead and laced his shoes exactly the way he did, just to save him some time. He refused to wear them. I'd interfered with his routine. He had the equipment manager get him a new pair, unlaced, so he could lace them himself. He practiced and played in a routine as well. Every time he warmed up in practice, he started with a chest pass. The greatest player in the world working on a basic chest pass. Why? Routine. Basics. Fundamentals. The court was his battlefield, and he knew where all the mines were planted. If you can't master the fundamentals, you can't master anything else. Even before games, in the tunnel, he would go through the motion of a chest pass, watching an imaginary ball release perfectly off his fingers and thumbs, spinning its way through his mind, cutting through the unnecessary thoughts in his head. His fundamentals were so well rehearsed, he never had to think about those basics during a game. He knew if he could get to a certain spot on the court, nothing could stop him. Most players have a spot like that. MJ had them all over the floor. That was his minefield. He knew exactly where to position himself and where his doomed opponents would be blown up. No different from elite military executing a complex operation. Routine isn't an option, it's imperative. Every detail is planned, mapped, and required. The team has to work in complete synchronization, or everyone is at risk. From the way you're taught to make your bed to the precision and accuracy of jumping out of a plane, there is no room for creative options. The decisions have been made for you. Don't think. Execute. Part of MJ's greatness was that ability to execute. Even the smallest details of his movements enabled him to act and react faster than almost anyone else on the court. He could get his shots off quickly because he caught the ball with his knees bent and his shoulders already squared up to the shot, so he was already in position to shoot. Most players catch the ball and then get in position to take the shot. MJ was already there. The gun was already locked and loaded. He rarely had to reposition his body or turn his shoulders after the pass. All he had to do was catch and turn his head to see the basket. To this day, I don't even know if that was something he learned or if it just came naturally to him. But it eliminated a split second of not having to think about those extra steps, not having to waste physical and mental energy. That's how you control your mental battlefield. Why was routine so important to him? Because the games themselves were so unpredictable. Not uncontrollable, but unpredictable. And controlling the unpredictable was his specialty. He never panicked, never flinched at unforeseen obstacles. Rodman thrown out of a game? No problem, we'll pick up his rebounds. Scotty injured? No problem, we'll handle his points. Team being dismantled at the end of the season? I got this. Give me the ball and get out of the way. You can't manage any of that if your mind is battling everything else in your life. His routine allowed him the mental freedom and clarity to focus on one thing, the complexity of the game, and managing every variable that stood between himself and a win. He planned for the unpredictable and structured his life to minimize the impact it would have on his performance. But the greats understand you can't plan for everything. Winning respects your routines and habits, but it thrives on the unpredictable and will keep throwing fastballs high and inside, sometimes at your head, until it throws the curveball just to see if you can adapt and handle the unexpected. If you can only do things one way, if you can't operate outside your own system, winning gets bored and finds someone else to play with. A routine may allow you to set a portion of your journey on autopilot, but to get to your ultimate destination, you're going to need total control over the outcome. That's the difference between a winning quarterback who can call an audible in a bad situation and turn it into a success, and a failing quarterback who can only execute the play he rehearsed. If you're flying a fighter jet, you can't leave complete control to the autopilot. You must be ready at all times to override the system and handle the unexpected. Many of us had to face that challenge during the COVID-19 pandemic, which disrupted or altered almost every aspect of our lives in some way. Suddenly, basic routines changed or disappeared altogether, with limited options to put things back the way they were. All the things that were part of a daily routine, what time you got up, when you left the house, when you went to the gym, where you had lunch, who you saw and spoke to, what time you returned home, what you did when you came in the door, how you relaxed in the evening, what time you went to bed, were suddenly altered or eliminated. Every routine, every habit, every procedure had to be replanned and relearned. For some, it was a disaster because they couldn't cope with the rapidly changing landscape. But for others, it was an opportunity to get rid of old habits, break old routines, and find a new way to do things. For many, it exposed the pointless habits and systems we plug into over and over without any real benefit. I use the situation to challenge my clients, especially those in business trying to create a new normal for themselves and their teams. Why do you have this routine? For fear? Boredom? Strategy? That's how it's always been done? You don't know another way. What are you limiting by clinging to this? How does it help you win? For pro athletes who live by the schedule and routine, the quarantines and new protocols presented an interesting challenge. When you play one way your whole career, in front of fans, surrounded by family and friends, on a set schedule that never varies, it takes an extra level of focus to deal with a new reality, from empty stadiums to the NBA bubble. Some handled it with no problems. Others couldn't handle the disruption to their routines, and it showed in their results. The difference wasn't physical. It was all mental. Every routine has to factor in the possibility of uncertainty. If you prepare only for one scenario, you have no chance of surviving the volatility of real game conditions. True in sports, true in business, true in life. If you can only function when things are done a certain way, at a certain time, that tells me you lack the ability to adapt to real-time variables. In basketball, for example, you can practice the perfect shot all you want, but in the game, you're never going to know how the pass is coming to you. Over the years, I've thrown countless passes to my athletes, and there were times they'd throw them right back because they didn't like how I threw them. Too high, too low, too hard, too soft, whatever. I once had an intern everyone hated, not because he wasn't great at what he did, but because his passes were too soft. Drove the players crazy. And I understood the intern's issue because even if you're strong, you probably don't have the strength of an NBA player, and you're throwing 1,000 passes a day to these guys, and each player wants the ball at a different height, different location. But every time he'd throw that weak pass, that's what they'd think about, instead of focusing on what they were doing. They wanted to see the ball at game speed. So, I'd throw unpredictable passes on purpose, and when they'd complain, I'd tell them, "How often in a game are you getting that perfect pass in the perfect location? You have to be able to reach here or there and be ready for the pass that isn't what you expected. I don't want you in that moment thinking, 'Oh shit, bad pass.' I want to see you reflexively catch whatever you're thrown." If a player missed a shot he should have made, we'd work on that by passing him the ball exactly how it had been thrown to him when he missed it, so we could figure out what happened and make sure it didn't happen again. I used to kill myself with these passes. Most coaches would stand under the basket to rebound the ball and pass it back to the player to take another shot. But in a real game, the pass can come from anywhere. So, every time my guys shot the ball, I'd run to the basket, get the ball, run to a different location, pass to him, run back to the basket, get the ball, run to another location, pass to him, because that was the precise battle they needed to fight. Not just the physical battle to master the shot, but the mental battle to stay focused when things don't go as planned. And yes, I could have had an intern or assistant do all the running and rebounding, and sometimes I did. But my top players wanted to see me work just as hard as they did. They needed to know we were going into battle together, and we would win the war together. I can still see the smirk on Kobe's face when he would miss a few shots on purpose just to make my ass run to get the long rebounds. The battle begins and ends in your own mind. Your thoughts have to be constantly renewed, like a daily subscription that must be paid so you can think clearly. You get updates for your computer and your phone. How often do you update your ideas, your strategies, your priorities? How often do you reboot your mental energy and delete the outdated programs and files? Action originates in your thoughts. Winning will pull you in one direction, but your mind will pull you back. It's too tough. I didn't expect this. I'm not ready. I'm not good enough. Are you confident enough in yourself to win that battle? Are you ready to gamble on yourself to win? We're about to find out.
This chapter is really about confidence, the belief in yourself, the ability to gamble on yourself. The greats all have this. They have certain traits that allow them to believe in themselves and never doubt the outcome, no matter what the odds are against them. You talk about how confidence is your ticket to freedom, and it's your gateway to shake hands with winning. How does confidence play into your work and what you see your clients do every day?
Listen, when winning allows you to get into the race, it gives you a ticket. But that price of that fare continues to go up and up and up. And as the fare goes up, what's your confidence going to do? Is it going to go up or is it going to go down? With every win, with every loss, with every step, you always gamble because you don't know what the next outcome is going to be. Confidence is something that continuously gets built as you stay in this race longer and longer. And the more wins you get, the greater your confidence gets. But the more wins you get, the more confidence you're going to need, because that next win, the ticket, is going to cost you even more. Number one, winning is the ultimate gamble on yourself.
The night before I began training Kobe Bryant in 2007, I was sitting in a little restaurant near my hotel in Newport Coast, and Kobe walked in for takeout sushi. I didn't know him well at that point. We'd talked on the phone numerous times after Michael had told him to hire me, and had crossed paths a few times over the years, but we'd never really spent any time together. That was about to change dramatically. Over the years, numerous players had asked MJ if they could use me to train them during the season, and always got his standard response: I don't pay him to train me. I pay him not to train anyone else. But at this point, he was already retired, and he genuinely wanted to see Kobe play at the highest level for as long as he could. I'd seen and heard all the comparisons between the two, done my own homework, and was ready to find out for myself how similar or different they actually were. The first major difference I noticed: Kobe Bryant was able to walk into a sushi restaurant at dinner time, and not one person ran over to him for pictures or autographs. I'm not saying that to be critical or disrespectful, just being factual. Michael could never have done that, ever, and I'd spent so many years around him, I'd come to expect that every superstar was treated the same. Our work together began the next day at UC Irvine. Kobe was quiet, reserved, totally focused. We talked about his knee issues, some other things he wanted to work on, and the one thing that had been on his mind for a long time. He wanted to learn everything he could about MJ. The program, the schedule, the workouts, the whole routine. He wanted to know about Michael's lifestyle, how he reacted to certain situations, how he handled teammates and coaches, and anything else Kobe could add to his arsenal of weapons. He wanted knowledge. Not so he could become MJ, so he could become a better Kobe. Most players who have asked me about MJ over the years are looking for ways to copy his mentality and his game, which can't be done. I can list all the traits and habits and philosophies that made him great, but the secret is in how they're put together, and that's unique to every individual. You can take every ingredient in Coca-Cola, they're listed right on the can, and combine them in 1,000 different ways, but you'll never be able to replicate Coca-Cola, because it's not about the ingredients. It's about the formula for combining those ingredients. When you're iconic, you can never be duplicated. Kobe understood that. He wanted to learn so he could implement certain things that would work for him and continue to elevate his own game. Because when you're already that good, there aren't many people who can show you how to get better. I'm often asked about the differences and similarities between the two. I don't like to compare because, to me, they were so different and unique that it's an injustice to both. But if you want a basic summary, I'll give you this. Kobe worked harder. MJ worked smarter. Kobe never stopped. He questioned me about every aspect of our training. He needed to know why and how everything worked. He didn't always want to be there, what we got left, but he always did the work, and he always came back for more. He was insatiable for game film. He'd watch a play over and over and over, processing what happened and how he could make it happen better. He carried a DVD player everywhere. This was before iPads, so he could watch special videos made for him by the team. When that wasn't enough, we brought in my director of player development, Mike Procopio, to break down film on every game and every opponent studying and strategizing for every possible scenario. From 2 a.m. to 4 a.m., that was Kobe's focus, unless he was in the gym putting up shots. If there was an open gym at 3 a.m. and he wanted to work on something, he'd be in that gym. I never slept during those years, I just napped, because you never knew when he'd be ready to get back to work. We'd be on the court at 3 a.m., and by 4:30, I'd make him leave so he could get some rest. But I'd stay, because I knew he'd sneak back in 15 minutes, and I'd have to make him leave all over again. Of all the things we worked on, the most challenging was simply getting him to stop. In athletic performance, everything is about go, 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 and up, 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 with not enough time and attention paid to stop. Winning needs you to occasionally stop, land, listen, see, smell, learn, understand. If all you can do is go, you will eventually run right past winning and not even recognize it. MJ knew when to stop. He processed things so quickly that he didn't need to study as long and hard. He just knew. He'd look at film, but usually just to confirm what he'd already replayed in his mind. His head was like an infinite library of images and moments and plays. He recalled every action and reaction and knew how to prepare for whatever was ahead. You'd never find him on a court at 4 a.m. He slept at night because he knew sleep was part of his training, and as I mentioned earlier, we'd work out almost every day at 5 a.m., 6 a.m., or 7 a.m., depending on our schedule and time zone. Occasionally, he'd want to do a late-night training session while we were on the road, just to make sure we got it in. One time, he wanted to go straight to the gym when we landed, and I had to borrow a t-shirt from him because I didn't have time to go to my room and change. 2 years later, he saw me wearing that t-shirt again and remembered that I never returned it. The man never forgot anything, as we all saw in The Last Dance. He never questioned what we were doing or why we were doing it. He relied on his ability to feel what was working for him. I'd give him the program, and we'd get it done. Usually, he'd have me do it with him, so he'd have someone to compete against. But his goal was to be efficient and effective, as it was with everything. About those 5, 6, 7 a.m. workouts, our entire conversation after games would sometimes amount to me asking him, what time? And Michael shooting back a number, 5, 6, or 7. But I've never explained why we always switched it up. Winners need to be at their peak in any situation, regardless of time zone or location or other variables. For you, that might mean getting to a meeting in bad weather with flight cancellations, or a last-minute schedule change that forces you to get up earlier than usual, or something else that throws you out of your comfort zone. For my athletes, it's essential that they perform at the highest level at any time of day in any time zone. If they're always training at the same time, their bodies get acclimated to one thing, which doesn't work if they're playing all over the country, and especially if they're playing coast to coast within a couple of days. So we always vary the times of our workouts so my athletes can be prepared for anything. While MJ was all about efficiency, Kobe was all about more. If some was good, more was better. Michael knew when he'd done enough, so he could move on to whatever was next. Over the years, I've thought a lot about what made them each so special, and no question, each had immeasurable traits that defined their greatness. Skill and talent, of course, work ethic, intelligence, commitment, resilience. But above all, they had this in common. They each possessed an unshakable confidence in themselves that never wavered. They didn't have to know what was coming, but they were always ready. They knew when to take the shot and when to pass to someone else. When to talk and when to stay silent. When to speed up and when to slow down. When to respond to criticism and when to laugh it off. For Michael, it was believing he'd get past the bad boy Detroit Pistons and the physical abuse they heaped on him to become the best who ever played the game. Ignoring the criticism and skepticism when he retired from the NBA after 3 championships to explore a career in baseball. ignoring more criticism and skepticism when he returned to the NBA almost 2 years later, when everyone said he could never be as good, and then winning three more championships. Giving everything he had to the Last Dance Bulls, knowing the team was going to be dismantled at the end of the season. He never recruited superstars to play alongside him, although the organization was always asking him to do so. At one point, the Bulls management asked him to be part of a conference call with Sam Bowie, who was a free agent at the time. Everyone made their pitch to Sam about why he should join the Bulls and how much the team wanted and needed him in Chicago. Phil made his pitch along with Jerry Krause and Scotty, and then it was MJ's turn. "Sam, you coming or not?" he said. "We're winning with or without you." His belief in himself was so powerful, he never doubted the outcome. Even after he retired, he was still finding ways to invest in himself and his abilities. He bought the Charlotte Hornets and became the first NBA player to be majority owner of a team. He remained an integral part of Nike's Jordan brand, which earned over $3 billion in 2020. He started and ran numerous new ventures and businesses. He competed on golf courses, including the private course he built for himself. He competed in fishing tournaments. He didn't have to do any of that. The man is already worth over $1 billion. But winning is an addiction like none other, and once it shows you some unforgiving love, you'll crave that love forever. It was no different for Kobe. Everything he did was about his massive belief in himself, starting with his decision to skip college and go right into the NBA. He won three championships alongside Shaq, and then spent the rest of his career proving to himself he could win without Shaq, twice. He learned five languages, including Mandarin Chinese, because he knew the NBA was going to be huge in China, and Slovenian, so he could trash-talk Luka Doncic from the sidelines. He'd speak to Lakers teammate Pau Gasol in Spanish, so none of the opposing players knew what they were going to do. He played through injuries that would have destroyed most players, rupturing his Achilles but staying on the floor long enough to make two free throws, and then asking if there was a way to just tape it up so he could keep going. And after his basketball career, when most players are trying to find ways to cling to their glory days, he went directly into the entertainment business, winning an Oscar for the short film Dear Basketball, which he narrated and executive produced, and also writing best-selling children's books. And he shared his love of basketball with a new generation of players, investing his time and passion into coaching his daughter Gianna and other young girls to a standard of excellence most NBA teams couldn't match. I have no doubt he was preparing Gigi to be the first woman to play in the NBA. That's how you bet on yourself. For both MJ and Kobe, it all came down to a relentless belief in whatever they did. The same is true of all the greats I worked with. Dwayne Wade, Charles Barkley, Tracy McGrady, Scottie Pippen, Hakeem Olajuwon, and so many others. Every decision, every move was rooted in confidence. In the early days of Michael's career, a reporter asked his coach, Doug Collins, about his strategy for coaching the greatest player in the game. "It's pretty simple," said Collins. "Give him the ball and get the fuck out of the way." The greats don't need to be told what to do. They already know, and they always find a way to make the gamble pay off. Very few people are able or willing to bet on themselves. They become the assistant manager of their own lives, waiting for directions and approval from some higher authority because they don't feel confident enough to make decisions and take action on their own. Confidence is the ultimate drug, and winning is the dealer. It's the cure for doubt and insecurity and panic and low self-esteem, the antidote to the free fall you experience when you're losing control, the vaccine for fear and weakness. But there's no prescription for it, and no one can give it to you. Either you feel it deep in your gut and bring it out, or you don't. Whenever we talk about what's deep inside us, instinct, I go back to the undisputed experts, babies and little kids. What are we born with And what are we taught? We all start out confident. Babies take their first steps, fall down, get up, fall down, laugh, cry, get up, fall down, and they keep going. At no point do they say, "I'm done with this, I'm sitting, forever." They do what feels right, and they don't care what you think about it. If they don't like what you fed them, they'll spit it out. When kids see a puppy, their first reaction is to play with it. It's not until someone teaches them, "No, don't, be careful," that they learn hesitation and fear. Little kids sing and dance for no reason. They draw crazy scribble pictures and dress in whatever feels right to them. They've got one purple boot and one orange sneaker, fairy wings and a hard hat and four t-shirts, and they're singing "Happy Birthday" to everyone on the street. Until the adults get involved. "You can't wear that. You look crazy. Get in the house. Change your clothes. It's nobody's birthday. Why are you singing?" And no matter how confident those little kids are, eventually someone shames them out of it. Or something happens to make them believe they're not good enough in some way. Very few kids have the ability to ignore that, and it stays with you. Every successful individual can tell you about the humiliating moment, or moments, that defined their level of confidence and made them choose losing or winning. For MJ, it was being cut from his high school basketball team. Tom Brady was the 199th pick in the NFL draft. Kobe had his famous airball game as an 18-year-old rookie in the 1997 playoffs when he shot an airball at the end of the fourth quarter and then three more in overtime. Dwayne received only three college scholarship offers when he was in high school and was declared ineligible to play his freshman year at Marquette because of academic issues. Charles Barkley, who weighed 300 pounds as a rookie, asked teammate Moses Malone why he wasn't getting more playing time and was told he was too fat and lazy. Scottie Pippen began his freshman season at the University of Central Arkansas as the team equipment manager. None of us is safe from winning sixth sense of humor. Just ask the sales rep who falls one deal short of earning her bonus, the NFL kicker who misses the game-winning field goal, the pitcher who blows up in Game 7, the lawyer who loses a huge case on a technicality. If you're a winner, everything after that becomes a never-ending commitment to keep betting on yourself, a decision about what comes next. Where do I go from here? Am I this bad? Or am I so much better than this and now I need to prove it, not to everyone else, but to myself? For me, there were so many of those moments, I can't recall them all. As a child, I started first grade at age 4. I'd just arrived in the United States with my dad and they took his word for it when he said I was already in first grade and was immediately put in the class for kids who couldn't keep up with the rest of the class. I couldn't read out loud, and I couldn't spell. We'd have to get up in front of the class, and the teacher would give us a simple word. "Tim, please spell the word ham." I thought for a minute. Who cares how you spell ham? You eat it, you don't spell it. But okay. H-A-N. Hilarity all around the class. But I wasn't laughing, and it's still not funny to me. Although that story gets a great laugh when I tell it. Those things stay with kids. Looking back, some of my greatest humiliations were in the classroom, which was so wrong since I always had good grades. In my family, there was no other option. My first year in college as a kinesiology major, I'd talked my way into an advanced class without taking the prerequisite class that would have taught me what I needed to know. The professor started the quarter by having everyone stand and he'd ask questions of each student. If you couldn't answer, you'd remain standing for the entire class. I stood for 7.5 weeks, 3 times a week. Everyone else had answered his questions. They were all sitting. I stood there alone, sweating and embarrassed and furious with myself. Until I realized I could stand there and fail, or I could get the basic kinesiology book and learn what I was supposed to already know. To this day, I remember the moment I answered a question correctly. Ironically, It was during the 23rd class session, and the professor said, "Mr. Grover, you can sit down now." By then, of course, I'd already taught myself the entire course, and I wouldn't stop answering questions until finally the professor had to say, "Mr. Grover, I don't need you to speak now." I finally arrived. So did my confidence. Confidence comes to us in many ways, not just in how we see ourselves, but in how others see us. A few years ago, I was working with a group of CEOs and corporate leaders as part of a seminar on competitive excellence. Every individual in the room was successful, affluent, and highly respected among colleagues and peers. We were talking about the personal obstacles and issues they'd faced in their race to the top. "Who here has been told you were worthless?" I asked. A few nervous hands went up. "Stand up and stay standing," I told them. "Who has been told you're wasting your time?" A few more stood. "This is going to fail. You're never going to make it." More and more standing. And finally, "You're crazy." By now, everyone was standing. "I'm standing here too," I said. That last part was a compliment. Everyone who has ever accomplished anything has had the confidence to be a little crazy. Are we talking about you here? Are you working toward things that look crazy to others but make perfect sense to you? Are you betting on your own belief in your ability and vision, even when everyone else can't see it and wants you to stop? Don't stop. Excellence is lonely. No one will ever understand what you've gone through to get where you are. Of course, you have to have some reason to believe you can achieve what you're going for. You're not going to be the first 50-year-old NBA rookie. You're not going to win the Masters if you've never won your local neighborhood tournament. You're not going to become a billionaire by just looking at expensive things and wishing they were yours. Every day counts, especially for athletes who have a specific skill set with a tight expiration date. The greats understand the reality of that. Confidence takes on special meaning when everything is on the line. It's no longer just about walking in a room like you own it, or feeling good in what you're wearing, or knowing all the answers if anyone asks. When you're competing for the prize, when it's all on your shoulders, confidence is all about knowing, without a doubt, that you will win. That was Tom Brady, who left the New England Patriots after winning 6 championships, decided to play for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers instead, and at age 43, delivered their first Super Bowl title in almost 20 years. Confident people are their own special breed of killers. You can't break them because they've already been broken over and over. That's how they become so confident in the first place. Not from others telling them how good they are and throwing confetti in parades, but by being pushed down and kicked and laughed at, and by learning for themselves how strong and powerful they really are. By being in the worst possible situation and having the confidence to believe, we're getting out of this mess. Just ask the 2016 Chicago Cubs, who carried the burden of 108 losing seasons into Game 7 of the World Series against the Cleveland Indians. With the game tied and momentum swinging toward the Indians, a sudden storm swept in and forced the game into a 17-minute rain delay. Cubs outfielder Jason Hayward looked around at his teammates, saw them hanging their heads and preparing for the 109th season of defeat, and gave a stern talk that by all accounts lifted up the team and saved the game. His confidence became theirs. That's leadership. Confidence is feeling as low as you've ever felt in your life and knowing you'll recover stronger than you were before. It's hearing others tell you everything is fine, you're perfect just the way you are, and knowing they're wrong and you still have work to do. Consider the legendary Phil Heath, 7-time Mr. Olympia, fighting for his 8th title 1 year after surgery kept him out of competition. He could have walked away. He could have taken his medals and accolades and pursued many other opportunities. But he had the confidence to try again and prove to himself he could still do the work and compete at the highest level, knowing the outcome was not guaranteed. Confident people don't live in the past. They remember what happened, but they don't let it affect their ability to move forward. They understand that losing is inevitable, and they recover as quickly as possible to get rid of the stink. I don't want to see an athlete slumped over, hiding under his hoodie at a post-game press conference. If you blew it, if you sucked, if it hurts like hell, admit it, own it, and show confidence that it won't happen again. When you're still in the middle of the race, there should be no difference in your demeanor until the race is done. When you've been knocked down, confidence gives you the patience to stay down for a minute, until you know how to get up better than you were before. Most people jump right back up because they don't want to look weak and damaged, and then immediately get knocked down again. When you're confident in your ability to recover, you know you'll never be weak or damaged again. We're all flawed. Confident people don't hide their flaws. They laugh at them because they don't care what you think. Those flaws work for them. They don't have to work for you. Confidence lets you hear the voices around you and in your own head without responding or reacting. You can hear them without listening to a single word. Confidence gives you the grit to stand in the shadow of those more powerful than you and still retain your power. Every one of my clients was wealthier and more famous than I and had the power to terminate our relationship at any time. But I never let that influence how I trained them and how I approached our relationship, and I never forgot why I was there, to deliver results that no one else could produce for them. That was my power, and I never gave it up. Confidence is your ticket to freedom, your escape route from everything that's holding you back. Bad relationships, bad decisions, bad situations. The people and issues that stand between you and what you want. Never let anyone take that from you. Even when they control the situation, they don't control you. Ultimately, confidence is about taking chances and never doubting the outcome. You can't win if you can't gamble on yourself, and you can't gamble if you don't believe you can win. Winning requires you to set unrealistic goals and expect to achieve them. That doesn't mean chasing unattainable dreams. It means making smart, educated, and confident decisions about what you're capable of achieving. When you're making those decisions and enjoying the results, life is